Mary Carter, you're from where?
Lompoc.
Say it again.
California. Lompoc, California. I'm Mary Carter. Dr. Bill, California.
Hi, Dr. Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Gil Lahr, where are you from?
Wilmington, Delaware.
Hi.
And this is Sandy Davis in Miami.
Hi, Sandy. One of our
Virginia's here too.
Pardon?
Virginia is here too.
That's good.
This is Rob Hansen from Milwaukee.
Hi, Rob. You have a dog?
I do, but mine's not barking.
Okay.
Hey, what number's the mute button? I forgot.
Rich Gardner.
Star 6.
Thank you.
Who else hasn't said their name?
Jeff from Vermont.
I didn't get that. Jeff?
Jeff from Vermont.
Vermont. Who just came on?
Scott Taylor from McKinney, Texas.
God. What's the name of the town?
McKinney, Texas. It's outside of Dallas.
Uh-huh. You've been on before, right?
Yes, I have.
Yes. Is anyone else on that we haven't got the name yet? Okay, we have a very full agenda tonight. I'm going to take co-chair privilege by just, I was talking to Gary McKenzie, he was on the first, I may have bollocked your name a little bit. I would really like, I'm going to talk about this on the agenda tonight, but it's called the Jobs Not Wars campaign. And I hope everybody on this call tonight will sign the petition. Not necessarily during the call because we have to pay attention to the call and find some other people to sign it. It's going well, but I just want to start getting it in your mind, the Jobs Not Wars campaign. Well, I'll explain that later. Virginia, this is really your call.
All right. How are we doing? Should we...
I have
702. I'd wait a couple more minutes.
Yeah, let's do. Yeah. Well, I could say something now. I could say plenty about the Jobs Not Wars. There's somebody else. Who's this?
Susan Oller from Asheville, North Carolina.
What's your first name?
Susan.
And it's Susan Lester. Thank you.
Tom Gallagher, San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. It's really good to have all of you on the call. I guess it wouldn't hurt for us to announce ourselves, those of us who... I'm Sally Weiss. I live in Western Massachusetts, and I've been co-chair of this call for a couple years. And
I'm Virginia Hoffler. I'm Sally's co-chair. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona.
And we're going to have tonight two other planner people speaking on the big topics that you probably have on the agenda, and that's Mark Levin and Sandy Davies. And we have also Rob Hansen, who's going to talk about Progressive Central later on in the call. All right, is anyone else on the call that thinks we don't have your name? We wish it were easier that once we have your name, we would know how to contact you. And we thank those of you who do sign on. In register, that helps some, but that still doesn't quite get us to, you know, to you in a certain way. It's weird. after the call, we get your phone, everybody's phone number, but it doesn't, of course, say your name. It just says your phone number. So, anyway, I think maybe another person who works on this call all the time is Rich Gardner. And let's try for the chat room, as we try every month. And on the chat room, you will see, if you didn't see it on the agenda that you got, you will see Virginia's and my email addresses. And that would be a way to communicate back to us. We have a Google group. It's a little hard to get onto it. And we're working on how to make that easier so that we actually have a listserv and we could talk to each other more than once a month on this phone call. But Rich will try to get us on chat room, because once you're on chat room, you can see Rich tries to keep up with the conversation and put things down. So, Rich, could you try to get us on again? He may be doing something technical. He also records these calls and some other stuff. Rich? Okay. I'm not so good at explaining it. So.
Well, if you just go to the website www.pdacommunity.org, and then at the top there's issues. And under issues, you go to End Wars and Occupation. And then on the right hand of the page, you'll see Sally's picture and my picture, and keep going below there, and you will get to the chat. But you can sign on right through Facebook, or you can sign on through the site.
As a guest.
As a guest.
And then you can talk, you can print, you know, you can email us during the call as well as, you know, it's not too large a call, so we'll be able to take people's questions. But the idea is to have an interactive means during the call. Any questions on the chat room? Anybody successful at getting on? Okay. It might be time to start.
Okay. Well, this is Virginia Hall-Flair. I want to welcome everybody to the call. We have a jam-packed agenda, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Our first speaker is Mark Levin, who is going to give us a report on what's going on in the Congo and a positive role that the United States could possibly play there. Mark?
Sure. Thanks, Virginia. What I wanted to do tonight in a short period of time is to talk a little bit about the history of the current conflict and its toll, really a horrendous toll it's taken on the population, and what U.S. involvement has been so far and what it could be in a constructive way going forward. With 68 million people and vast natural resources, I'll call it the DRC for short, the Democratic Republic of Congo, should be one of the largest economic engines on the planet. Its untapped deposits of raw materials are estimated to be worth in excess of $24 trillion, and that's untapped deposits. So those are areas of wealth, you know, beneath the Earth's surface that have still not been mined and draw an awful lot of attention. And one of the reasons that we're talking about it tonight is that as the Afghanistan war winds down, or at least we hope it winds down, I think we have to be vigilant about other potential hotspots and start to think about how PDA could think about being a positive force in containing or actually taking situations that are tinderboxes like Congo and preventing major outbreaks, and also just really promoting peace in a way that is constructive and practical. Congo has a long and, as many of you may know, really one of the more horrible...
Terry Leonzi, Hollywood, Florida.
Hi. Colonial histories. In the late 1800s, King Leopold II was actually granted a personal fiefdom of the Congo at the Berlin Conference, where the European powers, because of their fear of each other's gaining an advantage in Africa, essentially carved up the continent, obviously without any input from Africans. And during that 20-year reign, when the Belgians under King Leopold exploited rubber and ivory, it's estimated that as many as 10 million Congolese people were murdered in the process. If you ever have a chance and want to read more about it, King Leopold's Ghost is a really horrifying but wonderfully written book by Adam Hochschild, and you could read more about it there. But instead of being the world's potential, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, in fact, it's the poorest country on the earth, and where the average per capita income is $300 U.S. dollars a day, less than a dollar a day for an entire population of twice as large of as it is in Afghanistan. The current conflict really goes back to independence days. In 1960, a democratically elected popular leader, Lumumba, was overthrown. Many people say with U.S. complicity. There's a lot of research behind it because of his ties and closeness with the Soviet Union. And he was replaced by Mobutu Sese Seko, who for the next 32 years pillaged the Congo for his largely for his personal use, and really fragmented the country. So throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, because there was really no government that functioned very well except for the personal wealth of Mobutu and his entourage, basically the country splintered into various city-states, which became increasingly isolated from each other. And as you would see today if you were to visit, what had once been a rather perhaps the most elaborate system of roads and transportation in Congo, for example, there are virtually no roads left in Congo. You cannot go from east to west across which really is a large country about the size of Western Europe. And in many parts, the formal justice system also disappeared. Certainly, police officials and public officials were not getting paid by the central government. And other countries began to take advantage, particularly because of the availability of wealth. The genocide in Rwanda also played a major feature in what's become a really long nightmare for most Congolese people. During the genocide, Rwanda's post-war government invaded the Congo in pursuit of the Hutu militias that were largely responsible for the massacre of 800,000 Tutsis. And then they didn't really leave. They also backed a rebellion against Mobutu, which in some respects was, I guess, a positive development after 32 years. But they installed someone who was essentially an ally of theirs, Lawrence Kabila. And once Kabila took office, he really tried to minimize the influence of Rwanda on his administration. And really that caused a major cross Africa, really almost like a mini world war in Africa, in which as many as nine countries were at war within Congo. Angola, Namibia, and Zimbabwe sided with Kabila against the Rwandan and Ugandan rebels in the east. Virtually nothing was done by any of any outside forces. The United Nations sent their first mission of about 5,500 troops, but the war just raged on for about 5 or 6 years and has really continued in the East in particular in episodes and rather violent outburst episodes through today. Some of you probably have followed the developments at the end of 2012 to the present, where M23, another Rwandan-backed militia, has rapidly advanced through North Kivu and actually overtook Goma, which is the major city of the north. And now there are supposedly negotiations about to start in Uganda between the militias, Uganda, Congo, and Rwanda. These meetings had happened before, and they usually just lead to a shuffling of new militias controlling particularly the eastern part of the country where most of the wealth is. That wealth is one of the ways it's manifested in our lives, I think, and one of the things that's been actually the hallmark of some of what the advocacy has been for change has been the minerals that are used in high incidence capacitors in cell phones and computers. And so it's a very lucrative business. And in the chaos, most of the mining companies that originally been in Congo have left, and so a lot of the battleground is over one militia displacing another militia and smuggling out these minerals to Rwanda and Uganda. The effects have been the bottom line effect has been that estimates raised between 3.6 and 5.8 million people have died directly as a result of the conflict. Almost 4 million people have become internally displaced refugees. Rape happens on an average of over 1,000 rapes a day. It has been going on at that rate for at least 7 or 8 years. One of the things when I spent some time in Congo 2 years ago, it's closer to 3 years ago now, so I think one of the most disheartening things that I heard was that even in parts of the country where rape had not been part of the for lack of a better word, social fabric of the community, even after conflict stopped temporarily, because the conflict kind of takes bursts in different parts of the East, rape has become, and domestic violence has soared and has become to the point where two-thirds of all women report that they've been the victim of domestic violence, in addition to the more highly publicized mass rapes that we hear about frequently. Only 27% or about 25% of the 68 million people have access to clean water. Only about 60% of children go to primary school. HIV/AIDS has not become a major problem, probably because there's not much traffic through Congo. But other public health indicators, including mortality, and the average age now is down to 55 years, about 56 for men and about 53 or 54 for women, which is actually usually the reverse. Not much is really being done. The United States, I just want to say in contrast quickly to Afghanistan, not that death is any better or murder through war is any better for one population than the other, you should really compare them, but estimates about deaths directly through the war in Afghanistan, which has a little less than half the population of Congo, is about 15,000 to 18,000, compared to, even if you were to multiply that by 2.5, which would equalize the population, doesn't come close to the 3.6 to 5.8 deaths attributed to the war in Congo. The United States' position throughout the conflict since it began has been really most of the time to support, they supported Mobutu most of the time because he'd been able to convince the United States that he was a stalwart anti-communist. And because of particularly the rebellions in Angola and Mozambique and also in Rwanda, the United States was particularly, like they were in most of the Cold War paranoia, willing to support anybody who at least would make the pretense of being anti-communist. So the United States provided military aid to the Mobutu regime and turned its back on all of its excesses. It also was deeply influenced by the United States policy was also deeply influenced by the genocide in Rwanda. So even after the Cold War ended, the United States was not particularly involved in the region much at all, not been a strategic until actually early in the 2000s when after 9/11, I think there was more interest in what might be going on in the region. The United States was very hands-off all throughout the early years of the war in Congo and has championed Rwanda ever since. Some people say that that's largely because of the Clinton administration's guilt over having known enough to be able to have done something and really minimized what may be happening, and it did not intercede. And in fact, in many ways, Rwanda has been considered an economic miracle. When I crossed from eastern Congo into Rwanda, the topography is exactly the same, but you definitely immediately know you're in a different place. There are roads, kids are not wearing rags, There's even a genocide museum in Rwanda. But much of the Rwandan wealth and the economic miracle has come from its pilfering the minerals in eastern Congo and supporting the militias very actively, including M23 now, in essentially the economic rape as well as, unfortunately, the physical rape of women in the country. And activists have been trying to push the United States to take a position, and I must say that there's some good news in that the United States did finally suspend military aid to Rwanda a few months ago. And actually a clip I guess you can actually see on YouTube, the president directly called President Kagame in Rwanda and was heard to say that, suggesting that they desist from supporting M23. Rwanda, of course, even though the UN report, and actually you can, there's the presence of Rwandan troops again in the east, has denied any involvement. In terms of advocacy for ending the war, which most people feel is directly connected to the terrible poverty in the country, has been an interesting group of people, some of whom have been in the anti-trafficking modern slavery movement. Others have been environmentalists because the war has caused tremendous destruction to the ecology of Congo. Obviously, human rights advocates, and some of the international women's advocacy groups. And together they've focused their attention on two kinds of strategies. The first is to try and control the mineral trade, and also the second really is to try and stabilize by pushing the United States to become more diplomatically involved and really align itself with UN efforts. So right now, if you were to look at the activist agenda for most of those groups, there's been several long sign-on letters, or many signatories to sign-on letters, urging the president to name our own envoy to lead a coordinated U.S. response to the crisis. Would really be the first time that the United States would engage in multi-country diplomacy in the region. They've also been pushing, and it looks like successfully recently, to up the sanctions on Rwanda and also to make similar threats to Uganda. Uganda has not been as interventionist in the last few years as Rwanda has been. On the other front, the activists have taken really have been to figure out ways to harness Congo's wealth for the benefit of the Congolese, and that really is hard to do without a peace process. So that's why, you know, what I just spoke about is a major push ahead, and I think should be something that folks, organizations like PDA, can get behind. The other is to try and push for greater regulation and also some economic planning that really would return the wealth. So, for example, this is to me a major breakthrough in the U.S. Tucked into the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act is an SEC regulation that makes it compulsory for companies that are publicly listed doing business in the DRC to produce an annual audited conflicts mineral report. So that a big push on this is to push electronics companies in particular to trace their supply chains. And that's not a particularly easy thing to do when it comes to coltan and considerite, which are the minerals that are used so much in modern electronics. You can do it in gold because gold and diamonds have a chemical footprint. You can kind of tell where they came from. You can't do it with the other minerals now, including tin, although there looks like there's close to a technological breakthrough to allow that to be done as well. So Dodd-Frank is being really fought against, as you might imagine, by the National Association of Manufacturers and others. And really, I think we need a strong activist effort to make sure that's not stricken from the Dodd-Frank bill. I don't think it's high on the administration's agenda now. I think it was pushed through. It took a couple of years of really hard fighting by advocates to do it. And it's one of those kind of an add-on. It took the SEC 2 years to issue these regulations. And I occasionally stay on the law firm. I stay on the law firm website listservs to see what the corporations are up to with regard to Congo, and they are not happy with this development. at all for the most part, but there are some good guys. The tin producers and also in the electronics field, Philips and Motorola, have actually been real champions of reform. And it kind of makes sense that they would be, because if things calm down in Congo, it's to the economic benefit of most corporations. There's also been a push to try bring industry into the mining industry back into Congo, but to do it in a way that's human rights based. You can have a rights based industrial industry initiative, kind of an oxymoron. And there have been some interesting experiments. So, for example, a few years ago, USAID funded a project that involved the Congolese government, both national and regional, mining companies from Australia in particular and Canada, induced the companies to come back to Congo so long as they agreed to treaties with the Congolese government that would really set up a system of royalties, something that's not ever been done in any systematic way. But in order to induce them to come, the European banks through the EU had offered financing for the companies to foot the bill to come back to Congo. It's not a cheap place to work. But the condition was that human rights, each of those companies would have to submit to human rights audits every year. It has not been wildly successful, partly because there's been enough chaos. The corporations haven't quite believed it would be in their interest to come and mine. There have been some successes outside the East, but they've been relatively small in gold mining. So I think it's a very positive development overall. The other thing which is part of this kind of package that people are talking about, is making companies work with local NGOs. And there's surprisingly, I was shocked when I was there, pleasantly shocked, that there's a rather robust civil society in the East, incredibly heroic people. I don't think I've ever met people like this anywhere else that I've been in the world looking at development programs. The agreements with the mining companies are, and now with some electronic companies, is there will be a certain amount of money pooled for economic development, but the companies won't control that money. Local communities will. And there have been some interesting experiments where I think it's worked out well. Communities have been able to gather some of the technical assistance about ways that certainly people know how to solve their local problems. That's ultimately what's most important. Local communities have really taken some steps. Yeah, I'm about to finish up now, actually. And this is the kind of thing that I think we really should think about getting behind at PDA. And I think the U.S. government is crucial to it, and they've shown signs that they want to support it. Just, I think, largely a matter of putting it on people's radar screen, because you just don't hear a lot about Congo unless you're looking for it. So that's my report, and I hope that we have future discussions about it. And I'd be glad to answer some questions if we have some time for it.
Yes. Do we have any questions for Mark? I do hope you'll keep us updated on the developments there. And if there are particular NGOs that need our help and our attention,
I'd be glad to start putting together materials if it's appropriate to put it up on our site, on the PDA site.
Great.
Mark?
Yeah.
This is Lois Hamilton in California. Hi, Lois. Hi. Can you recommend any good books, recent books that have been written that could explain this whole situation? Are there any good books out there that you can recommend?
I think the best stuff out there are actually monographs that some of the human rights groups have done, and I'd be glad to try to think of the best way to do it, is send some of that information to you. I don't have it at the top of my head, but it wouldn't be hard for me to either to put some stuff up on the site or to send it to you directly.
If you could put it up on the site. I'd like to learn more about it.
Sure, I'd be glad to.
Jeff from Vermont with a suggestion for you.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not just about, you know, the areas of Africa we're talking about tonight, but it talks about the face of imperialism and what the empire has done. I do not like to call it American Empire because I'm an American and it's not me. But read Michael Bymite. It's a short read, and it really talks about imperialism and empire all over the world, okay? Mm-hmm. It's Michael Parenti, The Face of Imperialism.
The face what?
The Face of Imperialism.
Okay.
And it's Michael Parenti. It's P-A-R-E-N-T-I, Michael Parenti.
Parenti, okay.
So
thank you.
Very worthwhile read in just a very short book. It takes what he's talking about in Africa and puts it in context for you all over the world in terms of what empire has been doing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mark. And, yes, we'll get some resources up on our resources page from Mark. Our next speaker is... Sandy Davies is going to talk to us about all the airstrikes that have been continuing to fall since Obama became president, where we are here with the missile strikes and drone strikes. Sandy?
Yeah, thanks, Virginia. Hi. Yeah, well, we're hitting two kind of unspoken-off topics tonight. You know, Democratic Republic of Congo and U.S. airstrikes. You know, we've been hearing quite a lot about drone strikes lately, and obviously people are very concerned about that. It's a very dangerous precedent for our leaders to believe that they can, you know, kind of strike at will anywhere in the world without putting Americans in harm's way. It's the ultimate dream of American militarism, you know, to actually... be able to kill people in other countries without U.S. casualties and without the political backlash that comes from U.S. casualties. However, what we're not hearing is that under the Obama administration, these drone strikes actually make up less than 10% of the total airstrikes that are taking place, mostly in Afghanistan. Barack Obama took the oath of office, he has been responsible for, by my count, at least 20,130 airstrikes. And looking at these 4 years compared to the 7 years of Bush once the global war began. If you take out of that the 2 months, the March and April 2003, when the U.S. conducted 29,000 airstrikes against Iraq, what they called shock and awe, if you take that out of the picture, in fact, day in, day out, the Obama administration has done more bombing than the Bush administration did. Obama's airstrikes amount to every day in, day out, since he took the oath of office, one airstrike every 1.75 hours. And, you know, that compares to Bush, sort of maybe one about every 2.5 hours. So now most of those are in Afghanistan. That's over 18,000 under Obama in Afghanistan, of which only 1,160 have been by drones. So, you know, again, as I say, that's much less than 10%. Added to that, at least another 116 airstrikes in Iraq since Obama took office. And then last year in Libya, NATO conducted about 7,700 airstrikes, of which the U.S. conducted at least around 1,500. So that all adds up to over 20,000 airstrikes under Obama. And I think there are three ways in which our propaganda system basically keeps these keeps the reality of this out of the public mind. One is simply by not talking about them, just simply so that most Americans have no idea of just the scale and regularity of this endless bombing campaign. Second, we're not really, nothing in our media really reminds us of the destructive nature of these weapons. You know, it's all talked about in euphemistic terms. And then the third thing is this very, very sort of sophisticated propaganda campaign surrounding the whole notion of precision weapons that never, of course, actually analyzes just how accurate or inaccurate these weapons are. And once you take all of those things together, I think you get a very, very different picture of the horror of this entire campaign. So, you know, we've talked about the sheer scale of it. But, you know, another thing, when we talk about the destructiveness of these weapons, most of these are 500 or 1,000-pound bombs. Every one of these bombs is designed to inflict damage, death, and injury over a wide radius, you know, up to hundreds of feet from their points of impact. You know, it depends exactly, you know, if they're landing in the open or in buildings, or, you know, just exactly how much damage they do and how far from the point of impact the damage extends. You know, we know that when American or other soldiers have been the victims of aerial bombardment and shelling, many of them have never gotten over it for the rest of their lives, you know, with what they used to call shell shock, or we now call PTSD. And yet, in these current wars where, you know, we've conducted almost 100,000 of these airstrikes, what our leaders refer to as the battlefield is, in fact, very often a euphemism for people's houses, villages, or even urban areas densely populated by civilians. And under international humanitarian law, a lot of this simply violates the Fourth Geneva Convention and other provisions of international law. During the occupation of Iraq, the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq issued regular human rights reports in which they detailed civilians killed in U.S. airstrikes and demanded that the U.S. military thoroughly and publicly investigate these incidents and prosecute whoever was responsible for the indiscriminate use of force that was killing civilians in Iraq. Of course, the U.S. never followed through on any of that. So no, as far as I'm aware of, and if I'm pretty sure this is right, no American has been held criminally accountable for civilian casualties in airstrikes in Iraq or in the much, much more widespread bombing of occupied Afghanistan. It's important to realize that while the U.S. conducted 29,000 airstrikes during the invasion of Iraq, subsequently, in 8 years of occupation in Iraq, it conducted less than 4,000 airstrikes, whereas comparing that to Afghanistan, we have conducted almost 10 times as many airstrikes in Afghanistan during the period of occupation as we did in Iraq. So this is, you know, over this whole time period, close, you know, 50, 60,000 airstrikes in Afghanistan. Now, the second, you know, the second thing is the destructiveness of this. Mark mentioned a figure of 15,000 people killed in Afghanistan. That is just the most gross underestimate. I'm sure that's a published figure he found somewhere. But basically, you know, the UN mission in Afghanistan puts out these figures, which are based entirely on the very, very, very small number of incidents that it is that are reported to the UN and that the UN is then able to thoroughly investigate. And, of course, the UN has no access to, you know, the probably at least one-third of the country, which is essentially under the control of the Taliban, which is where most of the airstrikes are taking place. Going on to this whole notion of precision weapons, because I think the public has been more or less brainwashed to believe that the bombing that our Air Force and Navy do nowadays is very different from, you know, the bombing in World War II, or where you know, they just destroyed entire cities. And it's true that the, you know, these precision weapons are more accurate. Now, the best analysis I've seen of just how accurate or inaccurate they are was during shock and awe, during the invasion of Iraq. The Associated Press talked to Rob Hewson, who is the editor of the international military journal Jane's Air Launched Weapons. This is basically a trade magazine for the bomb and missile industry. And he estimated that of the 20,000 precision weapons fired or dropped into Iraq, about 20 to 25% of them completely missed their targets. So, and then, of course, there were about another 9,000 bombs and missiles used in that assault that were not even classified as precision weapons in the first place. So overall, you actually only have about 55% of those 29,000 weapons that actually performed with precision by the military's own standards. And then we have to realize what those standards actually are. The Mark 82 500-pound bomb, which is probably the most commonly used bomb in these campaigns, if you look it up in the military specs, it has a what they call the circular error probable of 9 meters. That is to say that they consider it accurate if it falls within about 30 feet of its target. And so when we're talking about, 75, 80% accuracy, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about 75 to 80% actually hitting, you know, the exact target. So really, you know, we're talking here about tens of thousands of bombs and missiles raining down on these countries. There's really been no assessment in Afghanistan, no epidemiological study of, you know, just who and how many people are being killed by this. In Iraq, you know, we had, thanks to people from Johns Hopkins and Columbia University and the Al-Mastansiriya University in Baghdad, we had two reports in The Lancet that really bore out, you know, what Rob Hewson's analysis. By the way, what Rob Hewson said at the end of that interview with the Associated Press, he said, in a war that's being fought for the benefit of the Iraqi people, you can't afford to kill any of them, but you can't drop bombs and not kill people. There's a real dichotomy in all of this. That's someone who, you know, who's the editor of a weapons trade journal saying that. What the authors of the Lancet reports said was in their first report, which was after 18 months of war and focused probably more on the actual shock and awe at the beginning of the war. They said, and this went along with saying that about 100,000 people had been killed, they said violent deaths were widespread and were mainly attributed to coalition forces. Most individuals reportedly killed by coalition forces were women and children. Violence accounted for most of the excess deaths, and airstrikes from coalition forces accounted for most violent deaths. Now, when they went back after 3 years of war, they found a lot more varied causes of death, but one thing they found consistent was that overall U.S. airstrikes still accounted for half of all violent deaths of children in Iraq. So there's really no reason to think that the pattern of civilian casualties is any different in Afghanistan under the much, much heavier bombardment that the people of Afghanistan are going through. If someone is eventually able to, to do a real study of the civilian casualties in Afghanistan, I think it will very possibly be, in something like on the order of what we saw in Iraq. Here we are. Obama's about to be sworn in for the beginning of his second term. And I think, this really needs to be part of our focus, whether the bombing continues in Afghanistan, which it has, even amidst all the, all the talk of withdrawal, the number of airstrikes in Afghanistan January through October 2012 were 3,600, only very slightly down from the year before. Last year we had NATO conducting 7,700 airstrikes in Libya, and the death toll there is estimated by the new government at 25,000 to 30,000. Other estimates put it higher. So whether we're talking about Afghanistan or whether we're talking about, some new battlefield, as they call it, some new place where people live that our government is going to launch thousands of airstrikes against, whether it's Syria, whether it's Mali, whether it's, big escalation in Yemen, or, there are so many places. We now have special forces operating in 120 countries around the world, usually about 70 at any one given time. And, this whole, the level of destruction that our armed forces, particularly through airstrikes, are inflicting, is really something that we need to put back front and center in talking about, Obama's second term. As Barbara Lee said in 2001, she warned, let us not become the evil that we deplore, and that is exactly what we have done, in response to 3,000 Americans being killed, we have now launched these wars that have, killed, 30 times that at least. Actually, what do I mean? 300 times that. So
Sandy, we don't see any end to this at the current time, do we?
We don't see the public outrage. We don't see the public awareness that this is even happening, and that's, I guess, that's the main point I'm trying to make.
Hello, my understanding, this is Lois again in California, it's my understanding this John Brenner, too, who is going to be appointed as the new defense secretary, is the czar of this kind of air bombing, air killing, and the drone warfare. Do you know about that?
Well, I'm sure that, well, this is really the CIA's drone killing program that he, I mean, he's going to be the director of the CIA. And
that's what I mean. Excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and he's
I misspoke.
Already, yeah, I mean, he's already involved in that as Obama's so-called counterterrorism advisor, you know. But, yeah, what the part of this that is being conducted by the CIA, you know, has basically been a fivefold increase in drone strikes and airstrikes in countries that we are not even officially at war with. You know, there's a fivefold increase from Bush's second term to Obama's first term. That includes at least 303 drone strikes in Pakistan, 125 air and drone strikes in Yemen, and at least 16 in Somalia. And this past year in 2012, they really kind of shifted from Pakistan to Yemen. There were more drone strikes in Yemen this past year than in Pakistan. And I think, you know, U.S. officials, I mean, this is an incredibly dangerous, this whole technology is dangerously attractive to our leaders. And it's, you know, even as it is only a small portion of the bombing, of the death and destruction that we are inflicting, it keeps growing, and that's really what makes it especially dangerous, because they seem to see this as an alternative to other uses of force, rather than, I mean, there are U.S. special forces on the ground in all these countries, Yemen, Somalia, presumably Pakistan, but this has been the hallmark of Obama's approach to war has been, you know, the use of special forces and drones and expanding to more countries. And so when we're talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mali and all these different hotspots around the world, if this is going to be the response, you know, this is just very dangerous.
Horrible.
Yeah, and I mean, what we did in Libya has in fact, you know, flooded Islamist fighters and weapons into these regions. You know, a lot of the weapons that were sent to Libya are now in Syria, and a lot of the weapons that were sent to Libya are now in Mali. And so this kind of it's back to this old way of the CIA conducting these proxy wars, you know, a few special forces training up local forces that are, you know, so that large numbers of American forces don't have to go and die, but it is just as dangerous, just as destabilizing, and, you know, it's not the way to go.
Yeah. Virginia, can we get to the
third part? Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Sandy. And Mark wants to give us a quick rundown of what's going to happen at Progressive Central at the People's Inauguration in Washington, D.C., coming up on January 19th. Mark?
Oh, it was me or Robson? It was me, I guess, huh?
Could I make a little prologue first? This is Sally.
Yeah, please,
Doc. I think all of us, when Obama was reelected, we all said this time we're going to push Obama into the progressive agenda. And I really see the election as being a fairly that the electorate, the people voting, were pretty progressive overall.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very pleased with how PDA is taking hold of this. Tim has really got a lot of different things going. The letter drops now happen every month, the same as the Brown Bag Vigil did. And that's something that everybody on this call can help with, because every one of us has a congressman, and every congressman can get the letter drop. So I assume that if you're on this call, you get a lot of blasts from email blasts from PDA. And then those letter drops are amplified then by now a phone calling arrangement that goes into the district to get those of us that live not just a couple of us, but maybe 20 of us calling into the district office and amplifying the letter drop that happened with the people that are doing that sort of thing. Then we have a progressive roundtable that's started up, as far as I know, it started December. I think Mark was part of the last one on January 3rd, and there's another one coming up January 7th, 17th, and people are invited to be in D.C. and help with that. So keep sort of peeled, your eyes peeled about the progressive roundtable. And before I want Rob or Mark to talk about the people, the Progressive Central more, but I started the phone call tonight with my topic, which is jobs, not wars. And so if you have a pencil or you have a good memory, it should be www.jobs-not-wars.org. And PDA, I am PDA's representative with the Bigger Peace Movement that formulated this petition. It's been pretty successful. We have now, with the help of David Swanson's organization, which has a little somewhat of a separate but really combined petition, we're headed toward 50,000 people signing. And everybody on this call should be one of those people, and we should all get 3 or 4 or 8 or 10 people that we know to sign it. So it's www.jobs-not-wars.org. And so let's fill out the rest of the time until 10 o'clock. If Rob, are you able to just say something about what's called the People's Inauguration or the Progressive Central that will happen in D.C.?
Is there going to be a question and answer session? This is Scott Taylor from McKinney.
Pardon?
Is there going to be a question and answer session?
Yes, we stay on after 10 o'clock.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Rob, are you there? No. Mark?
I can, Sally, I have the information here, so
good.
I can talk about it quickly. There's a special one-day event in Washington on Saturday the 19th of January from 8 to 3:30 if you're in the area. And basically it's going to be a series of panel discussions focused on the most critical issues that's facing us now. Time to start with a new administration. And some of the speakers include John Conyers and Representative Jim McGovern and Representative Raul, I always forget his name, Grijalva. Right, and Alan Grayson and Mark Pocan, and then some of the other folks who've been stalwarts in the movement, John Nichols, Michael Leidy, Becky Bond, Donna Smith, Medea Benjamin, and Bill Fletcher, and of course our very own Tim Carpenter. So it would really be a very intellectually stimulating, interactive day. And then in the evening, since folks have said, oops, what's that?
That's somebody's house, I think.
I have to keep my canary out of my room here when I'm fine. Because folks have also said, we get together in these events, sometimes we don't have enough time to socialize. There's going to be an evening event. They're calling it an evening of community comedy and celebration at the place where a lot of progressive groups have events at Bus Boys and Poets on 14th Street in Washington. And we're going to have some comedy, which Tim said is not typical. We're not the funniest people at PDA, I guess, but Rick Overton is going to be a special guest for to do some stand-up comedy. And then there's going to be a special award ceremony to thank Representative Jim McGovern for his leadership on issues. And Mimi Kennedy and Jim Hightower and Andy Shalal are also going to be there. So that's from 5 to 7. So it's going to be a really full day. And then also Progressive Central and many other groups are going to be represented and have tables and be available to network.
Hi, Mark. Sorry, my call dropped right when she announced.
So, Rob, maybe you can talk about the next day on Sunday. Everyone can participate in the Sunday one, is that right?
All right. Yeah.
Yeah, Sunday is kind of, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mark.
No, it's you. Go ahead.
The Sunday thing is kind of a planning session for different actions we're going to, and agenda items that we'll work towards for the next year. It'll be discussion about what's going to be in the letter drops, things that are going to be on the agenda for the Winslow Conference in February. One thing that I'm kind of pushing Tim on is we got the 10th anniversary at the start of the Iraq War coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And all the fantastic anti-war marches that happened around it at the time. Because the 10th anniversary is coming up, it would be a good thing for PDA to, through our chapters, to get together with other peace organizations and do commemorative events for the not only the citizens of Iraq that lost their lives, but the soldiers that lost their lives, and do kind of a vigil on that day. Maybe a whole series of things about working towards full employment economy, doing publicly owned state banks, the Robin Hood tax, Medicare for all. So it should be an interesting day of policy talk.
And Rob, are you suggesting this would be in regions of the country and cities, or in D.C., or both?
For the discussion on the 20th?
For the what you're saying, the anniversary of the Iraq War.
No. I'd like to push it out to all the different chapters to set up all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because I haven't heard anything from any other groups really. But I would guess there's other peace organizations that are probably working on planning some different stuff. And so for us to get our chapters involved wherever they're at throughout the country would be, I think, a very good thing to do.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you so much, Rob. Sally, anything else on the Jobs Not Wars? Do you know how many people have signed so far?
Yes, we're on the main petition. There's now something close to 24,000, and on David Swanson's Roots Action, there's 14,000. So that comes up to almost 40,000, and our next goal is 50,000. And there, for organizations, there's now something 131 organizations. So we're still working on it. We don't quite know when we want to roll this out. We want to kind of work with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, if that's going to be possible. All these people that are, will be at the Progressive Central on that Saturday, those kind of progressive Congress people, to try to highlight, the way the priorities in this country are just so dismally wrong, that we're putting so much money into the Pentagon, and we're talking about cuts from everything else. So, PDA has been talking about, PDA usually calls it prosperity, not austerity, and the Jobs Not Wars talks about jobs, not wars. But, it's all of a piece. www.jobs-not-wars.org. Please sign the petition and get other people signing.
Yeah. And next month we'll be having Father Roy Bourgeois from SOA Watch, Schools of America Watch, on our call. So look for our notice for next month. Thank you so much.
And we do stay on afterwards if people want to talk a little longer. But it is 10 o'clock. We're not recorded anymore. We're officially not.
So did somebody have a question for Sandy?
No, I'll just say hello at this point. I came in a little bit late. I mean, very late. I'm sorry. This is Dorothy from Sacramento, California, and I'm with the California Disclose Act that we have in our legislature right now. So as I get to know the group a little bit more, I mean, I've been paying dues and stuff at PDA, but I haven't done one of these calls before. But I
Dorothy,
would like
what is your last name?
Nable is a silent K, KNABLE.
In Sacramento. Okay.
Let's see. I was signed up for the call. You may see me there.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I had a doctor's visit. I'm sorry. I couldn't come in time. So I'd like to start, coming to these and eventually tell you about how our bill's going and whether it might pass. And then, that's important at the national level, of course, because it's about making sure that the citizens know who's paying for all political ads. Now that there's such huge money in